where I live.
Intruder alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 joint increase the power.
Friends, and thank you for joining us once again for the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. This time, we're going to be discussing Williams Electronics' 1982 arcade classic, Joust. Now, before we begin the show, I am so very excited to say that we've got something very special on this particular episode. Not quite an interview, but audio from when Joust world record holder Lonnie Lon McDonald visited the Arcadia Retrocade to make it the 106th location to have had a Joust machine rolled over to 10 million points. I'll go into further detail when it's time to share that audio. Now, Joust is easily in my top 10 arcade games of all time. In my youth, I was always attracted to the legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So if something had a hint of medieval flair, I was pretty much ready to pay attention. Joust did not disappoint. This was one of those games that I did encounter for the first time at the Showbiz Pizza of my youth, and it was crazy popular. It was part of its showcase row, that section of the arcade where they wanted to show off they had the newest and hottest arcade games. The first time I saw Joust, there were 8 machines, 4 of them back to back. Even at 10 years old, friends, I had learned, thanks to games like 1980's Defender and 1982's Moon Patrol, that if it had the Williams logo attached to it, it was most assuredly worthy of my quarters or tokens. Now, I briefly mentioned Williams Electronics way back in the first episode of the podcast, when I took a look at Moon Patrol. It has a long history that bears delving into just a little. Williams Electronics got its start back in 1943 as the Williams Manufacturing Company. Founded by Harry E. Williams, the focus was on electromechanical games, with 1944's Periscope and Liberator, as well as pinball tables like 1945's Flat Top. Harry is credited for coming up with the tilt feature that practically the entire pinball industry would later adopt, as well as designing 1950's Lucky Inning Table, which featured inward-directed flippers on the bottom of the table that, yet again, nearly all pinball manufacturers would copy in the following years. By 1974, the company had become Williams Electronics Incorporated, and had followed Atari's 1972 arcade juggernaut Pong with its own version, entitled Paddle Ball, which had been released in 1973. It was in 1980, though, they hit the home run with arcade players when the company released Defender, a game that broke records by selling 55,000 units. It was in 1982 when Williams released Joust. Programming duties were handled by Bill Futz Futzenruder, who has a most impressive list of games he has worked on, like 1982's Splat and 1984's Inferno, which was sadly never released, but is available on MAME. It's kind of like Crystal Castles, but with the ability to shoot at enemies. Bill might be better known, though, for the absolutely legendary pinball tables he's worked on, like 1986's Pinbot, 1990's Whirlwind and Dr. Dude. He also worked on the 1991's coin-operated bat game, Slugfest, which is basically a hybrid pinball machine where the player, using a single large flipper as a bat, tries to hit the ball towards various points on the table. If you do well enough in Slugfest's case, you're rewarded a baseball card that is ejected from the machine. I'm rather proud to say that this is one of the first machines that Shea got at auction, although it's not currently on the floor of the arcade. It is, however, totally loaded up with baseball cards. Bill also had a hand in the 1991 Terminator 2 Judgment Day table, as well as Bride of Pinbot and 1992's Doctor Who. And last, but certainly not least, my favorite pinball table of all time.
Welcome to the Monster Bash!
1998's Monster Bash, featuring the Universal Monsters, is at the top of the list of pinball tables I hope the arcade will add to its collection. Those of you that also follow the Saturday Frights podcast ought to know why this table is so dear to me. even if the Monsters are given a rather comical stance as a reuniting rock band. Now, the art design for Joust was handled by both Python Angelo, who you might remember we talked about on the Sinistar podcast, and Jan Hendricks. Python sadly passed away in 2014, but thanks to Lon McDonald's own site dedicated to Joust, entitled Joustmaster, which I'll be sure to include a link for on the Retros post, it was revealed in an interview that the addition to the game of the unbeatable pterodactyl was because lead designer John Newcomer wanted something included to keep the players from just occupying the game all day. Its design, Python says, was from his love of the Ray Harryhausen stop-motion animation work. Jan Hendricks, I couldn't find very much info on, with the only other game being 1984's Mystic Marathon. The lifelike designs of how the players ostrich and storks move and fly has been credited to Jan and Python studying Edward Muybridge's 1957 collection of photos of various beasts and birds entitled Animals in Motion. And bear in mind that Jan and Python hand-animated the pixel art for the game's sprites to get them so perfect. Sound design was by Tim Murphy and John Kotlerick. John would work on 1982's Bubbles and the pinball table Thunderball, which has nothing to do with the James Bond movie of the same name, and it looks like the table was never put into production. Tim Murphy worked with John again on Bubbles, but I'm afraid that is all the info I could find. Thanks again to Lonnie's Joustmaster site, we know that Ken Lance helped on Joust with support programming. Ken also worked on Bubbles and Sinistar. Seems to me that Williams Electronics had a tight little community of game developers back in the day. Now, as I have already mentioned, the lead design for Joust was handled by John Newcomer, a legendary name to be sure, who also worked on the 1986 sequel, Joust 2, as well as Sinistar. He went on to have a hand in NBA Jam and 1988's NARC. I think it is worth mentioning that in 1981, he got a job at Williams by, and get ready for this, submitting a rubber chicken with his resume tucked into its throat, which has got to be one of the most awesome ways to get hired that I can think of. John presented two ideas for games to develop using the Defender hardware when he was hired. One was War of the Worlds, of course based on the H.G. Wells novel, and the second idea was Joust. John wanted the game to be a two-player cooperative title, which, as you'll remember, is what inspired the gameplay design for 1983's Mario Brothers, which we talked about on the last episode. He also wanted the players to have a type of flying mechanic, and even though they were using the Defender hardware, he didn't want it to be yet another game with a space setting. Thanks to a trip to the local library, Newcomer settled on birds as being the player's method of travel, originally intending the mounts to be eagles. But he decided instead to go with an ostrich for its ability to move quickly on land, and the designer felt that with it having wings, it would be easier for the player to accept a flying ostrich over an eagle running across the screen. For the second player, the Joust team decided on a stork, as they felt it possessed a similar proportions to an ostrich. For the record, while both the ostrich and stork handle exactly the same in the game, I prefer the stork. It might be a color thing. Anyway, Newcomer then decided that for the enemy's mounts, vultures would be a proper choice, as they had an easily recognizable sinister quality. Let's go ahead and talk about the control scheme for Joust. The game tasks 1 to 2 players with filling the armor of brave knights on their majestic, well, ostrich and stork, controlling them with the aid of a two-way joystick, allowing movement to the left and right, with the addition of a single flap button, which must be tapped to flap your bird's wings, and thereby allowing your mount to raise into the air. The more you tap that button, the faster your ostrich or stork will rise. Players must maintain a steady tapping of the flap button to keep in air. Otherwise, you just drop from the sky. Although, no harm will come to the player. Unless they drop into the lava, that is. But we will get to that in just a bit. When using the joystick, pressing in a desired direction, the flap button also regulates how quickly you are traveling. The ostrich and stork can run on the ground or the floating ledges, or stoned clouds as the game's beautifully painted arcade publicity poster states. These heroic mounts can build up more than a little speed too, ending with a comical, almost roadrunner-like skid when they stop and change direction. I want to pause for just a minute and discuss Joust's promotional poster. Thanks to the generosity of Earl Green, the arcade possesses a framed print of it. I'll be sure to include an image on the Retroist post, but it's truly one of the most beautiful pieces of art for a game that I've ever had the pleasure of seeing. I think it's easy to see, from its medieval sci-fi design, why Python Angelo was held in such high esteem. As two knights sit atop their stork and ostriches, upon a stoned cloud, their lances held ready, from the distance, we can see legions of enemy knights on their armored vultures, while below, we can see the all-consuming and deadly lava pits, even the grasping hand of a lava troll, and so much more. Everything a player would need to know about Joust has been included on that poster. It also has a weathered parchment on the side that reads, "Proclamation, hear ye, His Majesty King Williams will receive his many subjects at his magnificent joust tournament in ye land of molten magma and stoned clouds. Whereat all able and brave knights shalt ride their bird and shalt fight with lance ye evil enemies, Bounder, Hunter, and Shadow Lord." Newcomer, by the way, had a bit of pushback from some of his fellow Williams co-workers in his design of the game controls. John theorized that the flat button literally would give the player more finesse on the control of their character than if they just used an 8-way joystick and removed the flat button. Of course, history has proven him quite right in this matter, especially after he chose the manner in which the joust between players and their opponents, and sometimes fellow players, would be settled. Which, to put it simply, is making sure that when you collide with an enemy, your lance is higher than your foe's. A successful joust will knock your enemy from its vulture. Transforming the evil knight into an egg that must be chased after and collected by the players. Not only for points, but to make sure the knight doesn't hatch from that egg and emerge stronger. For example, if you dispatch a bounder and he's allowed to hatch from his egg, he will become a hunter, and so on. Just before I jump into talking about those various enemies of Joust, I want to point out the stage design. While originally Newcomer had played with the idea of a scrolling landscape, like you have in Defender, he eventually decided on just a single screen as it would allow him to add greater texture to the environment, like the ledges or the stoned clouds. A player or the enemies, if they brush against the underside or edge of the stone clouds, will bounce against or off their rocky-looking surface. They can be landed on, however. But those ledges do not stay in place and will begin to dissolve in later levels, robbing you of not only a little protection from evil knights above, but places for your mount to land on. Actually, a pretty awesome bug came about with the addition of those ledges. I'll let John Newcomer explain it himself.
There was a bug when we first were working on the flying and the running of the ostrich, and we had neglected to consider is when the ostrich lands on some of the floating cliffs, of how's that handled? When does the animation call the running leg and the and then the non-leg flap sequence? So there's a lot of situations where the ostrich is, there's the cliff is floating and the ostrich will be flying, but he's not high enough to show his legs. So it'll just do a belly flop across the cliff. And on the one side of the screen, we had two cliffs that were staggered. And when he does a belly flop, there's a little hole of a couple of pixels, and it allows the bird to squeeze out between between the two cliffs. And we're we're racking our brains trying to fix it, but we were so embroiled in playing Cutthroat, where we would try to kill each other when we were playing and testing the game, and it became a really fun trick to do, is that someone would be hovering underneath these cliffs, and then you'd deliberately do the belly flop and squirt out and kill the guy underneath. And so we decided to keep that in there and call it a feature.
Joust features a wraparound screen, so if you exit from the left side of the screen, you will merge on the right, which, like the players, the enemies can use to their advantage, so you really have to keep on your toes, especially when in the later stages there are numerous and deadlier foes. Okay, the first evil knight you will have to face in the game are the Bounders. These foes are the most common and easiest to dispatch. In the beginning stages, you are faster than the red-hued enemies, but after the third stage, they can match you. The Bounders have a tendency to be a little slower to react to the player, preferring to keep at a certain height. Although, if the players are hanging around an area for too long, they will give chase by moving up or down towards the player. As I've already mentioned, if you are unable to pick up a bounder egg before it hatches, it becomes a hunter. You can still run your mount over the newly hatched enemies and collect the points. It will take a few seconds for a vulture to swoop down and pick up its new master. Now, the gray-colored hunters live up to their namesake. They will seek you out and quickly. They will continuously ram into your mount in an effort to secure a successful joust against the player. By the way, at times a player and an enemy will be exactly on the same level. When the two lances meet each other, both the player and the enemy are knocked back just a bit. The hunter's programming will even allow them to halt their flight, if the game realizes it can reach you easier in a different direction, with the foe changing directions with ease, although they do usually lose altitude when they do so. When you dismount the hunter and fail to secure the egg before it hatches, it becomes a fearsome Shadow Lord. The Shadow Lords are blue in color and have complete mastery of their vulture mounts, appearing in wave or stage 16. Easily outflying the players, they will attempt to, if you pardon the pun, lord over the top of the screen, where a player is hard-pressed to raise up high enough to win the joust. Where the Shadow Lord can seemingly stay at the very top, the players will find they bump their heads, dipping them downwards, which is usually when the lords land their attack. When you take out a Shadow Lord, and they hatch from their eggs, they stay a Shadow Lord, because how can you improve on near perfection? Of course, you will be dismounted from your ostrich or stork at some point in the game. Depending on which stage you're playing, you will reappear on either a pointed ledge or the bottom of the screen, coupled with the best sound from the game, in my opinion. Now, you'll be totally safe for those few seconds of resurrection until it finishes, or until the player moves the joystick or taps the flap button. Then we have the Lava Troll, who makes an appearance after Stage 3. Well, at least his hand does. Until then, you can run safely across the screen. After Stage 3, however, the bridges on the left and right-hand sides of the screen are burned away by the bubbling lava beneath, which sometimes is exactly where an egg will end up. Of course, you can't collect it once it goes into the lava. If a player or enemy flies too low to that lava, they will find the Lava Troll's hand has reached up and begins to drag them slowly into the perilous molten magma. A player and enemy can attempt to fight this. If they found their mount is locked in its fiery grip, they can just weigh on that flat button to escape. Generally, though, the enemy knights, especially the hunter, will seize this opportunity to land a successful joust against you. Last, but certainly not least, we have the Pterodactyl. Billed as the unbeatable pterodactyl in the game, and friends, let me tell you, back in the day, long before there was the internet, at my grade school, we absolutely believed this to be true. We didn't quite understand the reason for the question mark next to unbeatable. So, at the end of the school year, the 4th and 5th grade classes were taken to Showbiz Pizza. We were all given $5 in tokens, which, honestly, I'm willing to bet good money that the teachers themselves paid for this. It was during this field trip that one of my fellow schoolmates, Patrick Tyree, did the impossible. He killed the pterodactyl. Myself and a few others were watching when he did it, and I can tell you honestly, we all lost our minds. He had no idea how it occurred, but I can assure you that for the rest of the day, it was like Kevin Flynn was amongst us. Even on the ride back to school, each of us that saw it take place were busy explaining to the other Joust fans what went down. Now, the pterodactyl will make its appearance if the players are taking just a bit too long finishing a stage. They will swoop towards the player, and it's very hard to kill as it has a tendency to dip down or up at the last second. And the only way to slay the winged monster is if your lance manages to connect inside its mouth, and only at a specific frame of the pixel animation. Yeah, it's hard as it sounds. It turns out, though, that when Joust was first released, it contained a rather famous bug. Once again, I'm going to let John Newcomer explain it himself.
One thing that was a real frustration for me was I like to pride myself in thinking of all the little details. And when Joust originally came out, there was a nasty pterodactyl bug where a player could stand on the middle edge and just hold his position, and the mouth of the pterodactyl would hit right into the lance, and you could play the game almost infinitum. I never could. I'm just too slow, I guess. But a lot of really good players, when we first sent the game out to manufacture, could do that, and that really ticked me off, because I had taken every character. I had a grid paper of how big all the characters were. I mapped out what the intelligence, the flight patterns of all the birds and the pterodactyls were, so that nothing like that would happen, where there'd be an infinite bug like that, where you could just keep playing the game forever and ever.
Williams Electronics sent out a new ROM to the arcades to squash that very bug. Although, I've seen videos showing off this trick, and using it would certainly secure you the high score spot very, very quickly. Alright, let's speak briefly about scoring. Killing a bounder will get you 500 points. Dispatching a hunter earns you 750 points. Dismounting a Shadow Lord and you net 1,500 points. If you gather the first egg, it's 250 points, a second egg is 500 points, and a third egg is 750 points, and a fourth egg and beyond gets you 1,000 points each. If you catch an egg in mid-air, it's worth 500 points. Destroying the pterodactyl gets you 1,000 points, which should tell you how dangerous a Shadow Lord is, considering it's 1,500 points. And if you lose a life, you get 50 points. If you have a Cravenly co-player, or perhaps just by accident dismount the other player, it will earn you 1,000 points. If a player is able to not be dismounted on the survival wave stages, they will get 3,000 points. Cooperating in a team wave, not killing each other, the players will both earn 3,000 points. And the first player to secure a kill in a gladiatorial wave earns 3,000 points. Beginning on Stage 5, the player will encounter the Egg Wave, where they must fly around the screen quickly, gathering as many eggs as they can before they hatch, and have a fight on their hands. Additional Egg Waves will appear after every 5 stages are completed. Then, with Wave 8, and every 5th wave after that, the players must contend with the Pterodactyl stage. You can either do your best to dispatch the evil knights on this level, while avoiding the deadly winged beast, or go ahead and go for the points and peace of mind by killing it. Of course, in the higher stages, you will have to face off against up to 3 pterodactyls in these waves. Good luck, brave knights! The world record holder for Joust on tournament settings, only single player, is Donald Hayes, who netted 1,489,250 points on November 22, 2008. Lonnie McDonald is in second place for those settings with 1,134,000 points, set on December 26, 2015. Lon, however, holds the world record for the First Man Challenge. Of course, you could say he too is the world record holder, as Lonnie rolled 100 Joust machines in 100 weeks for a grand total of 1,000,000,000 points. At the Arcadia Retrocade, there was a great battle for the number one spot, thanks to Viviana Haney, John Munkus, and of course, resident champion Michael Dietrich. However, that crown has now been passed to Lonnie McDonald, after his visit to roll the arcade's Joust machine to 10 million points. In this bit of audio taken by Shea Mathis, the owner and manager of the Arcadia Retrocade, you'll get to hear how things went down when Lon managed to flip his 100th machine. Because in attendance at this special event, which was held on May 23rd, 2013, at the Williams Electronics Building, there was Walter Day, founder of Twin Galaxies, Steve Sanders, who you might know from The King of Kong, historian Mark Hoff, as well as WMS Industries' Roger Sharp, who you will hear Lonnie mention saved pinball. He's not exaggerating. Roger is the man who in 1976 proved to the New York City Council that pinball tables were not mechanized gambling, but a game of skill. The ban on pinball in New York City ended, and eventually everywhere else, when the AMOA, the Amusement and Music Operators Association, asked Roger Sharp to appear in front of the city council on a table he hadn't played before. Sharp pointed out that just by the amount of pool he applied on the plunger, he could direct the silver ball into a certain lane. which it most certainly did, proving one needed skill, not just blind luck, to play the game. That one silver ball in Roger's skill helped seal the fate on the ban of pinball across the country, a ban that had lasted for almost 30 years. Also there that day, to watch Lon roll his 100th machine, were John Newcomer, Python Angelo, and William Futzenruder. You will also hear Lonnie reveal the very, very special gifts that John brought to reward such an occasion. In truth, Lon had not just myself spellbound by his achievements, but my co-workers Andy and Ree, and of course Shay. Now, Lonnie was showing us the people and images he describes in the audio on his phone. He was not only a wonderful and kind soul, but so very generous with his time and memories of the event. I apologize, as any thoughts of important questions to ask Lon went straight out of my head as soon as I met him. So, prepare to hear my laughing a lot in this audio, because I'm so excited.
So that was kind of cool. And then, after I finished the 100th, and Roger Sharp, the guy who saved pinball,
right,
he was our MC. So it was pretty cool. As far as we know, I'm the only person who's played in the Williams Building.
Gotcha.
Which is, so it's like Billy Mitchell's, that guy.
Sure.
I'm the Williams guy.
Sure.
So that's pretty cool. But when I finished Site 100, John pulls out this tube. He says, I've got something for you. And it's two sketches, the original sketch by Python Angelo.
Right.
And the original sketch, we believe, by Constantino Mitchell. So one's this, with the animation. There's a little corner of the animation. I'm going to find those so I can show them to you. And the other one is this.
It's this, the marquee.
So I have those two sketches, and we took them to a conservatory and had them restored, and we have them framed in my house on my Joust wall. There's a wall that has world record stuff and Joust artwork and different places I've gone. So I'm going to pull those up, so that'll be fun for you guys to see.
Hopefully, they also did
Sinistar,
right?
He did a lot of Williams stuff. Let's see. I think how far back I have to go. I think it's. Oh, here's when I was at the Williams Building.
Oh, wow.
There's Steve. There's me. I did it in Tux. Let's see. There's John, Steve Sanders, his son, my wife, me, Walter Day, Barkoff. And those are the sketches. Those are the original sketches.
Oh, man.
And Python signed his. Of course, Python has passed away. There's one of the four, first four off the press. The post-it you have up there. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole development team has signed that one all the way up to Ken Fidesza, who was the vice president. And all the guys have signed that, and that's also in my house. So
wow.
I have some pretty cool Joust stuff. And,
well, you have some pretty cool Joust stuff that you friggin' earned.
Yeah.
when I was there, we had four Joust machines at the Williams Building that was brought in. One by three of them were Logan Hardware's, Zespi, James Zespi, and look how thin I was. Holy cow! What happened? old, gray, and fat in 2 years. I don't 3 years. And then one from Galloping Ghost.
Right, right.
So we had those four there. And while I was playing the original Red ROM one, which was kicking my butt for the first hour or two, Steve Sanders was and his son were teaching the people at Williams how to play Joust. And the whole time while I was sitting there, and if you pull up Mark Hoff's stuff, he was our historian on it, Newcomer is standing behind me going, he shouldn't be able to do that. He goes, and he was thinking of ways to make the game tougher, so I couldn't beat it. So it was great fun. There's actually like a reflection picture of him standing behind me watching me play going like this. So. But John's such a nice guy. He lives in Dallas. And what I want to do is find... and of course, here's the group of us. We did dinner the night before. And so I had... There's Walter and Mark Hoff, and this is Futzenreuter, the programmer. And Mark's sleeping.
Where were you guys eating, by the way?
Harry Carey's. Yeah, in Chicago. There's Python. And it's Python with my wife. And this is the whole group of us, to, you know, kind of sitting here talking joust at Harry Carey's. So it was a lot of, I mean, you know, somebody like Python and Newcomer have so much history in the gaming industry.
Of course.
Very, very cool. I wanted to find you a picture of...
I really, really want to thank Lon for not only agreeing to let Shay record that, but for letting me share it with you on the podcast. Joust was a successful arcade game, to say the least, selling 26,000 arcade machines back in the day. There was even a cocktail cabinet version, and this one was designed by Leo Lezia, one that allowed two players to sit side by side, instead of the normal design of sitting opposite each other. In a game like Joust, that would mean one player would be trying to play with the screen appearing upside down to them. Less than 500 cocktail cabinets were produced and are very rare and expensive. Joust also received a pinball table in 1983, designed by Barry Ausler and Constantino Mitchell, which I believe Lonnie mentions in that audio. The game includes artwork and themes from the arcade version, and in addition to a single-player option, it features competitive two-player gameplay, with the players on opposing sides of the machine. It's been said that less than 500 of the tables were ever produced. Joust being such a success meant it would get the home port treatment, and boy did it! You could play Joust on the Apple II, the Atari 2600, 5200, 7800, and the Atari 400, 800, XL and XLE, and ST home computers, as well as the IBM. There was even a version for the Atari Lynx in 1992. A port for the ColecoVision almost saw the light of day, but was cancelled. Though I've read that the ROM has been discovered, and even fan-made cartridges have been produced. Starting in 1995, you could play Joust on the Game Boy, and in 1998, the Game Boy Color. A version was made available on the Nintendo Entertainment System, and in 2005, through the Xbox Live Arcade, you could pick up a copy of the game featuring updated graphics. And at the time of this recording, this very week, you'll be able to play Joust and many other Williams classic titles thanks to LEGO Dimensions with the Midway Arcade Retro Gamer Level Pack. At the Arcadia Retrocade, Shay picked up Joust just a little after the first year the doors were open to players. It turned out to have a case of stage fright, as it almost immediately went down. But thankfully, our techs, John Munkus and Bo Counts, were able to get it back up and running and out on the floor, where it shares space with Robotron on one side and Defender and Berserk on its opposite side. It's a very popular game at the arcade, for good reason. Joust is not an easy game, but its fantastic design keeps players of all ages coming back again and again. And I think that about wraps up our podcast for this go-around. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast has a Facebook page, so if you can, hop on over and give us a like. It's a great spot to share your own arcade memories and enjoy the celebration of classic arcade and home video games. Our ending theme, which is entitled River Raid, was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. If you have any feedback for the show, or perhaps a suggestion for a game to cover, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. The podcast is available for download on iTunes, so if you have a moment, I would really appreciate it if you could stop by there and give us a positive review. It certainly helps to get the word out to new listeners. For further information about the Arcadia Retrocade, please make sure to follow them over on their Facebook page. I'll be sure to provide a link on the Retroist post. Of course, I want to give a huge thanks to the Retroist. When you need your daily retro fix, why not visit the Retroist site at www.retroist.com. have a token on me as we listen to a clip for the game I will discuss on the next show. This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye, and we hope to see you next time.